From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. How many of us regularly talk about religion or spirituality outside of a place of worship? Not many, according to a study commissioned by Jonathan Merritt. 5 years ago, the Emory-educated Master of Divinity moved from Buford, Georgia, to Brooklyn. Even he, the son of a former Southern Baptist Convention president, found it difficult to talk with people about faith, his or theirs. So he set out to see if other people in America were avoiding talking about God. And the answer, as he explains in his book, Learning to Speak God from Scratch, is a resounding yes. Jonathan's joining us now from New York City. Good morning.
Good morning. So good to be with you.
Well, Jonathan, that title, what does it mean exactly to speak God?
You know, I thought it would be fun to kind of coin a phrase. I mean, it's a book about language after all. And so I say in the book, when I got to New York, I ran into a language barrier, and it wasn't that I could no longer speak English, but I could no longer speak God, which means I was really having trouble having spiritual or religious conversations in general and using some of the words from the vocabulary of faith that I had grown up using all of my life.
And you even were questioned on using simple phrases like God bless you when people sneezed, you know, questioned about what do you mean God or bless? So what do you do in those situations?
Well, you know what the sad part of this is, what I did and what most people do is we just stopped speaking God at all. Because when somebody says to you, what do you mean when you say bless? What do you mean when you say grace? What do you mean when you say saved? What you start to realize is that even for an experienced God speaker like me, what happens is you start to realize not only do they not really understand what you mean, but you're not so sure you understand what you mean anymore either. I mean, a lot of us who grew up in the South or grew up in largely Christian context, how often do we stop and ask, what am I saying when I'm saying what I'm saying? Most of us don't. We never stop to question the words we're using. And so when we find ourselves in a context where someone does question those words, we precipitously lose confidence in those words, and then we stop having spiritual conversations altogether.
Well, you commissioned a study to see if those kind of disconnects happen to other people. This is a survey of 1,000 people. You found a fifth had not had a spiritual conversation in all of last year or the year preceding that. So by your study's count, only 7% of Americans talk about God on a regular basis. Why is that?
There are a number of reasons, and it's even worse than I thought when I first saw these numbers. I said, okay, only 7%? 7% of Americans, because, you know, 70.8% of Americans claim to be Christian, and there's some sort of breakdown happening. But when I decided, well, maybe that's just picking up on a lot of more secular or non-religious folks. So I decided to look at the practicing Christians in the survey, just people who say that they go to church regularly. I figured that number would go sky high. It would be really encouraging. And that number was actually really low too. Only 1 in 8 practicing Christians say that they have a conversation about faith on a regular basis. So Americans are not speaking God. Why not? Well, we decided to ask folks, people who said they don't really have a spiritual or religious conversations that frequently. We said, okay, why not? The number one reason is, you know, spiritual and religious conversations tend to create tension or arguments. And of course, if you've ever been at a Thanksgiving dinner with Uncle Philip shaking a drumstick at you, telling you what he believes the Bible says, you know what that feels like and why you might avoid it. There are other people who say that religious language has become too politicized. And of course, if you're on Twitter, if you watch cable news, you know exactly what this is like, because today you have pastors speaking like politicians and politicians speaking like pastors. And that sort of desacralizes religious language, and it causes people to avoid it. Another really common answer people gave is that they'd been hurt by these words. And you know, I talk to a lot of people, and they say the same thing. They say, you know, my pastor or my parent or my friends used spiritual words, religious words, to shame me or scold me, repress me, or oppress me. And when you have a negative memory attached to religious language, you stop using it. So there are a range of reasons why people don't use it, but most Americans, the vast majority of us, say that we are no longer confident to have spiritual or religious conversations in everyday life.
Yeah, so people think that they don't really know how to use those words. They feel ignorant, you know, they don't understand them. Now, there's a word I'm going to pick up on because there are several in this book that you really dive into, like brokenness. Now, that was a word that set off a dilemma for you a couple of years ago. Why was that?
You know, it sure did, because I say this early on in the book, that some of these words I chose and some of the words chose me. And brokenness was one of those words. A few years ago, I had spoken about sexual orientation, sexual minorities, in speaking of my own orientation. And I had defined it as being broken. And that sort of is a way that that word has been used in a lot of conservative Christian circles, that people who are not heteronormative, people who do not sort of conform to the kind of expected, the majority orientation, that we say, oh, they're broken, and that it assumes something went wrong. I mean, first of all, the question is, who broke it?
Mm-hmm. And how can it be fixed, I imagine?
And then how can it be fixed? And of course, what we know when it comes to sexual orientation now is, we've got a lot of great data on this, is when you try to, quote, fix sexual orientation, which is to say, to make a gay or a bisexual person straight, it doesn't work. And so what I say in the book is maybe we shouldn't use a word like brokenness or broken, and maybe I shouldn't have used that word to talk about individuals who are not broken, who haven't been broken, and who there is no possibility of, quote, fixing.
So it's not that you don't use that word anymore, but as you write about, sort of reconceptualizing these words, creating a meaning for them, founded in scripture in many cases and conversation. But I wonder, does that set you up for the charge of bending the word of God to your own will?
Yeah, you know, a lot, I've heard a lot of people sort of raise this question, and it is a fantastic question. The fact is, you know, I spent about 4.5 years writing this book, and I spent about 1 year studying linguistics. And what I found out really quickly is that linguists are like pastors. They're like columnists. They're like radio hosts. They don't agree on everything, but they do agree on this. Language either changes or it dies. And there is no exception to that. It will change or it will die. Every language is moving at any time toward either evolution or extinction. The thing that keeps a language alive is that the speakers are constantly wrestling with it, rethinking it, reconceptualizing it, critiquing it, reimagining it, to sort of confront the needs of their day. And I think that's what we have to do with a lot of these words, is really to start wrestling with them again so that they work for us once more.
I want to pick up on what you were talking about politicization of sacred words. And in the book, you specifically cite examples from Presidents George Bush and Donald Trump about that. And I wonder, given what you said about people avoiding talking about this because it makes them uncomfortable or they are risking conflict, if this is a kind of, you know, dog whistle to the faithful that I can be bold about saying these things, though you might be afraid.
You know, I did a YouTube series recently where I went down to Times Square and I asked people that question. Does it bother you? And, you know, I heard a lot of people say it depends. That was a real common answer, and it was one that surprised me. And when I said depends on what, they said it depends on who is saying it and why they're saying what they're saying. That if it's somebody who is believably religious, that has kind of a track record of being religious, then they're okay with it. And if they have somebody, a politician who's using religious language, say, for example, to celebrate the diversity of faith in America, that's okay with them. But if they're using it in a way that's manipulative, that doesn't really work, because it's clear you're using this language, this scripture verse, as a means to an end and not an end in itself. And so, yes, there is some nuance there. It's not religion and politics mixing is always bad, and a politician can never talk about faith in a way that is good or helpful. I think there are a lot of Americans who appreciate a president who has some sense of faith or religion or a higher power, but it's when that is used as a tool of coercion or manipulation that really tends to make that language feel toxic for a lot of Americans who say, you know what, this is holy language, and it shouldn't just be another tool in a politician's tool belt.
I want to pull at some of the threads that I'm hearing and read in the book about your encounter with a woman who is from the Baha'i faith, and you guys, you know, just really didn't understand each other. In this idea of evolving language, is there an assumption that we can share a common language as a culture or variety of cultures about belief?
You know, there are some words that cross over, but they have different meanings. So a word like justice or mercy, love, you're going to find these words in a lot of the world's great faiths. There are other words that are specific to certain faith walks. But I think something that I found that was interesting in this book is, and it goes back to Google. You know, these days I feel like the world is the 6 degrees of Google. Everything goes back to Google. So it's no surprise that this conversation goes back as well to Google. Google has compiled, going back to 1500, all of the words in the English language that were published in books, magazine articles, pamphlets, speeches, web pages, and they're searchable. So you can actually search the frequency of word usage at any given time. What we find is, when we analyze this data, is that there has been a massive decline in religious words that all faiths use, since about the mid-20th century. They've been declining by up to 50% or more. But here's something that's interesting, particularly for non-religious people. There's actually been a decrease in not just religious language, but there has been a decrease in that, but also the language of virtue, ethics, and morality. So words like courage have declined precipitously. Compassion words have declined. Kindness words have declined. The word grace has declined. These represent things that I think bind us together as human beings. I would imagine most people listening to this would say, I want to live in a world that's courageous and kind and compassionate and gracious. And yet, you look around at our world today and it's not kind or compassionate or gracious. And what we're realizing is that we've been shaping this culture through the words that we use or the words that we don't use for a very long time, that there is a connection between what we talk about and what we think about, and a connection between what we think about and the way that we behave and live as individuals and as a culture. I write, obviously, as a Christian because I am a Christian. There's no other way for me to write. But I think if you are from another faith, if you're listening to this and you're, you know, you're Hindu, Buddhist, a Baha'i, or you have no faith at all, you're going to find something in this that should concern you regardless.
Jonathan Merritt, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
That is writer Jonathan Merritt. His new book, Learning to Speak God from Scratch, is out now. Just ahead, getting people into the pews when religious sentiment is at historic lows. But first, two Macon pastors on race and privilege as proper subjects for preachers in the pulpit. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I think it is one of the tragedies of our nation, one of the shameful tragedies, that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is one of the most segregated hours, if not the most segregated hours, in Christian America.
That was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Meet the Press in 1960. Nearly 60 years later, a pair of church leaders in Macon, Georgia, observed that not all that much had changed. According to the new Georgia Encyclopedia, Macon is home to more churches per capita than any city in the American South. GPB recorded Pastor Jake Hall of the Highland Hills Baptist Church and Pastor Dominique Johnson of Kingdom Life Church as they talked about finding common ground between white people and people of color in their churches. Jake Hall begins.
I've been thinking a lot about this idea that I can turn off my participation in, or I can turn off my sensitivity to racial issues because somehow whiteness is not considered a racial issue.
Mm.
And yet that construct affects my life in similar ways that blackness affects your life. It is a racial construct that tells me who I am, that tells me both truth and lies. And I think part of the way this discussion usually rolls is that we focus on persons of color and we never talk about how whiteness needs to have a moment of confession in this conversation as its own racial construct.
Yeah.
In this whole system, it itself is a lens that has shaped my life, that continues to shape my life, that I have to try to achieve perspective away from in order, I think, to properly have a dialogue about what race is.
Yeah, I think you can't come to the table and have be honest unless you embrace that. Unless you embrace, okay, I'm a white male. Well, for you, right? I'm a black male. What does that mean, first of all, to ourselves, but to the society at large? So that plays into this whole thing with racism, right? One of the things that I always, and I know we have a good dialogue left in front of us, one of the things I always think about is my son, who is now 12, he, maybe like 4, 5 years old, we were at Chick-fil-A. I often tell this story. He comes out of the store, and he says, hey, the girl in the store, something. And the thing was, Jay, he didn't put a qualifier on it.
Yeah.
He didn't put a qualifier on it. And I thought about that. Like, he just said the girl. He didn't say white or black. And it happens to be a little white girl. He did. And I thought, like, man, at what age do we start qualifying it?
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing with us being pastors and theologically, one of the things I shouldn't say hate, that's a strong word, but crud at when people say God is colorblind. And I say, nah, he knows I'm a black man.
Right. You know, I approach this from the perspective of someone who knows enough to know better in my own place of privilege, my own background. But I see folks like me, too, enter into conversations like this as if we need to hear stories of tragedy or pain or terror or loss so that we can understand. And yet, I feel the other confession that needs to be offered is white folks should understand that without you having to rehearse a lifetime
of pain.
Of pain.
Yeah.
We should be able to see that because of common humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been in conversations like this in the past where the moment the temperature finally goes up in a room of folks who both know better is when we fall into this sense of rehearsing that pain for the benefit of a well-intentioned, quasi-liberal white folk who, you know, want to feel that with you so that they can grow.
I think it has to start with us.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we're saying we're leading people, I think hopefully this conversation, you know, carries out and maybe we can continue to have it, even amongst our congregations or just amongst friends. It doesn't even have to be in a church setting. Hey, let's just go eat. Let me hear your story. Do we need to hear more each other's stories more? Not the theater, I came through this. Just, hey, man, how you doing?
I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, just before holiday. It was a group of clergy. So it reminds me of this conversation. And it was white clergy and clergy of color, straight clergy and clergy of different sexual orientations. It was probably the most diverse room I've been in for a conversation about preaching in a polarized and politicized age.
Yeah.
And we got past a couple of days of this conversation, and at some point, you could tell the tensions in the room were high. And it was because there was a little bit of tone-deaf white-splaining going on.
Yeah.
And I had to confess my own guilt in that, because I like to talk. One guy, he just said the wrong thing at the wrong time, and finally somebody said, "You don't get a cookie for doing what's right. You don't get a cookie for having this conversation, for being here. No gold star." And I thought, oh, that's it. I mean, we have to get past wanting a pat on the back for our willingness to have an awkward conversation. We need to start achieving something together that goes beyond cookies and gold stars, because those are for children.
That was Jake Hall and Dominique Johnson in an excerpt from a conversation recorded earlier this year for the GPB series Macon Conversations. It was produced by Josephine Bennett and Grant Blankenship. Macon Conversations is made possible with a grant from the Peyton Anderson Foundation. During our listening tour over the summer, we followed up with Pastor Jake Hall. Dominique Johnson was unavailable. When we visited him in his office at the Highland Hills Baptist Church, I asked him to elaborate on what he means when he says he wants to be a new kind of Baptist.
I mean, when I say the word Baptist, what comes to mind for you?
Do I have to say that on tape?
You don't have to use the four-letter descriptions.
I think of fire and brimstone and white people, actually, oftentimes. I don't know why. I think because you said Southern Baptist. I think of a kind of rigidity, I have to admit.
I grew up Southern Baptist, and it was in a faithful but fundamentalist community in Columbus, Georgia, that I took my first steps in faith and learned how to say yes to God. But I found that restrictive. And so I had my own crisis to overcome of how do I both break free from that rigidity but still live into the community that formed me and malformed me both. And so for many of my colleagues and fellow students, that was to simply find a denomination that fit their present values and to jump ship, so to speak, or to say no to faith altogether. But that same angst made me go into the Baptist clergy in a different way. Because since they made me and they formed me and malformed me, I want them now to take responsibility for me now that I'm all grown up. But at this point, I see that as their story and not my story. And our brand of Baptist has just, they've taken a different road. And so I have found a vitality within the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship that seeks to create a space for all people. We don't always get it right. But at least in its founding DNA, out of this fracture from the mother church, so to speak, there is a bent toward liberty. And I want to kindle and nurture that in my own little neck of the woods here.
And you said for all people. So that means if you had a congregant who was transitioning, LGBT, gay, that would be okay?
Everyone is welcome at Highland Hills. Now, I can't promise you that everyone in the pew isn't going to raise an eyebrow or nudge the person next to them. I mean, we're human beings in the South. But in terms of the clergy and leadership of this church, there is no restriction on walking in these doors and being a part. We all stand on the same ground here. We all sit in the same pew.
So what is the role of you as a leader of a flock inside of that? We say, oh, this is how this group believes and this is how that group believes.
They intersect in my pews.
Tell me how, because that's a tough thing to manage.
What I hear you describing is this, that our current political discourse is highly polarized in a variety of ways, between liberal and conservative, between black and white, or between white and all people of color, between nationality, between citizenship and immigrant, or alien. And all of that makes less of us inside the church, from my perspective. And so part of what my job is here at Highland Hills is to remind people that the labels that they claim with such fervor on the way in the door are not the labels that are placed upon them when they sit down.
How about outside of that? Mm-hmm. When they go off onto their Sunday and make their lunch plans or whatever it is that they do, how do you see the mission of your church working beyond in the community?
Mm-hmm. Another thing that we've come to believe here about Highland Hills is that our mission and our life here, that we're not bound by the geography of Macon. And this location that is gorgeous and it's and bears a historic beauty has defined us ever since. And yet our mission here is to the city of Macon and to offer opportunities for sacred space, both here on our campus, but also within the city, and to seek its wholeness and its peace. And so we've recognized that this isn't just about us here as the membership of Highland Hills, but a way for us to curate a larger conversation with the people of Macon. And so the past few years, we've tried to press that a bit in our life and work, and also in the life and work of Macon.
How's that?
Well, we are the Baptist that will show up at Mardi Gras downtown. And in the midst...
Mardi Gras has not been a big participatory holiday for Baptists.
For the Baptists, no. You know
Catholics.
All of the jokes. You know all of the jokes about Baptists at the liquor store. This assumption that to be Baptist is to be not only righteous but self-righteous both. And so we've tried to simply show up where people are and be Christian to them on purpose. And I know that sounds both ridiculously simple and somehow strangely radical at the same time. And so we're the church that shows up on Fat Tuesday and offers your kid bacon and pancakes before you head off to an evening of greater revelry. And we show up the next morning downtown to impose ashes and offer blessings and to remind people that they are loved. We offer prayers and walks on Holy Week. We've partnered with a local Americana radio station, The Creek 100.9, to create a space that is neither sacred nor profane, but some odd mix of both that really does kind of destroy the distinctions between the two.
And your desire to get out of the building and interact where people are, it's very different than, you know, I've been at Mardi Gras and there are people there walking around with wooden crucifixes, you know, telling you that your soul can be saved at this point, which is not, I don't know how many people actually come to them at that time, but I don't know if that's the best technique for drawing people in. So you are doing something in a very non-traditional way. Are you considered a radical inside of the faith?
Living in the way that Jesus lived is always radical. And yet ordinary at the same time. Like, this is what Christianity should be like. I think what is extraordinary and terrible are the acts that you described of Christians showing up, placard in hand, and hell on their mind. And they are flat out going to show everyone that's around there the wrath of God. But that's not what people are called to do. But you're not supposed to show them hell. You're supposed to give them a taste of heaven and to weaponize the Bible and to turn the cross into something that can injure rather than redeem is to move backwards and not forwards in faith. And it is an immature tantrum on display. And so we have found in our congregation for these moments to be life-giving. And so this impulse to get outside of ourselves starts to show up in a lot of different ways. So it's instead of recreating the wheel in trying to do good work here in Macon, we partner with nonprofits that are already doing good work in Macon. And we create space for our people at Highland Hills to conspire and partner for the care of our city in and with and through these organizations. We've set aside the kind of tourist mission trips that so often mark church missions where you send a team off to an exotic locale that has real poverty, and they come back with their stories, right? There is a place for that if you're truly investing in a context. But too often, it's a cheap vacation and a kind of trauma objectification that is not good for anyone, when especially there's real poverty in the backyard in Macon. And so rather than simply sending folks elsewhere to do a little bit of good, we fund and partner with people internationally who are working with underserved people groups. We reserve a lot of what we do for Macon. I mean, part of the arc that's happened to us collectively is that we want to be present in the life of Macon, that it's not about us setting the coffee and turning the lights on and saying, hey, everyone, come discover us, because what's really great about this is us. It's about going out into the city. And, you know, if we believe that God is at work in the city, making it more whole and more peaceful, then we should be a part of that work wherever we find it.
Jake Hall there. He's pastor of Macon's Highland Hills Baptist Church. And just ahead, we're going to talk to a panel of clergy about how they reach people inside and outside of the church. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. First, we want to thank all of you who've called or posted with your encouragement and suggestions during our first week back, and we are going to run through some of those on Friday's show. But as for tomorrow, he's a recovering drug addict and former enforcer for the North Georgia KKK. Then his life changed, and now Chris Buckley counts a Muslim cardiologist as a true friend. What do you think? Can hate be cured? Leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457, or you can tweet us at OST Talk and then join us for a Life After Hate conversation. That's tomorrow at 9 o'clock. We're talking this hour about declining religious sentiment in the U.S. and how people of faith are challenging that and inspiring new conversations about belief in the Bible Belt. And we're joined by three ministers now to talk about bringing vitality and new voices to their respective congregations. Kim Jackson is with us. She's from All Saints Episcopal Church in Atlanta. Kim, thanks so much. You biked in today.
That's right. Thanks. It's great to be here.
An inspiration for all of us. And also Anne Henley Saunders is with us from the First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
Anne Henley, I should say. Wilbur Purvis is also here from Destiny World Church in Austell. Welcome, Wilbur.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That would have been a long bike ride.
Yeah, it would have been.
I guess so. Okay, so we've heard national trend, decline in church-going population. Quick, one hit. Seen that at your church, declining population?
I'll go first. No. All Saints is a really vibrant and lively church. We have about 3,000 members, and we are of all ages, and really a growing and vibrant place.
Okay, how about you for you, Wilbur?
We're close to the same. I do notice, like, high school through college age, there sometimes tends to be a dip with kids going off to school and, you know, changing addresses and whether or not they come back to church. So I have noticed a little dip there.
How about you for you, Anne Henley?
I think Wilbur hit the nail on the head with change. I see a changing landscape within our context and within the global context of the church about what being a person of faith means and what that looks like.
Yeah, big, big picture stuff there. The Pew Research Center, however, shows more millennials, especially now, religiously unaffiliated. So younger people are leaving the church or never find their way in the first place. Anyone, why do you think, Kim, you're nodding, so I'm going to start with you.
Sure. So I am a millennial, and I recognize that most of my peers are not in church. And I think a lot of that has to do with some change in thoughts around what it means to be a thoughtful person, and that Christianity in particular has gotten a bad reputation of not being a place where thoughtful, intellectual people are welcome. And so I think that's a part of it. And also, I think a lot of people my age have been hurt by the church.
Yeah, we heard that from Jonathan Merritt. Right. And also someone from Facebook, Georgia, said, I left the church a long time ago. The hypocrisy of good Christians is one of my main pet peeves, but says that she discusses religion regularly with a coworker, a liberal evangelical. So that whole question of how do you discuss religion? How do you cross that that boundary and have those kind of conversations with people who may not be believers. Is that something that you in your church are working with, Wilbur?
I think on the hypocrisy piece, that's always an interesting conversation to hear people bring up as it relates to the church. I think the church has to convey and say to our congregations and outside of our walls that the church is much like a hospital, that we're not attempting to present some image of something that we're not. I think maybe I don't know if that happened in the past or not, but I think we have to be honest and authentic and say that, you know, we're learning and we're growing and we're developing. We're not this perfect utopia. It's a hospital.
So a place to heal, you mean that way?
And because it's a place to heal, I expect people who are in need of healing. It's a hospital.
But no one's expecting a miracle cure. Or maybe they are.
I think they are. I think they think that that you're not going to have those issues. But I would never go to a hospital and not expect to see sick people. When I go to a hospital, I expect to see sick people who are on their way to healing and restoration and wholeness. But this whole hypocrisy piece, I want to admit that I have my own flaws, my own failures, and that I'm attempting as a pastor to reach a destination just like everybody else who is in there. And that is a place of wholeness, a place of healing, where I can become authentic, but it's a process.
So Anne Henley, you at your church, you work with a number of millennial and youth groups. And millennials are often described as, you know, disruptors, rejecting the ways of their elders. So how are you approaching that age group in particular and addressing some of these issues that people bring with them? It's a place for hypocrites. You know, you may say one thing in the church, but you may behave a different way.
Great question. To Wilbur's point as well, I think that hypocrisy is part of our sin. And so I don't expect church to be a place where hypocrisy doesn't exist. I expect church to be a place where we name our hypocrisy and we're called to, by God, to heal from it, as Wilbur said, and to redeem it. We're called to be a part of a body that attempts to be honest about who we are and who we're called to be. And fundamentally, that's about loving God and loving neighbor. And because of our humanity, we can be often hypocritical about that. But church is a place to deal with that, to wrestle with that, and to ultimately grow from that experience.
So how do you create an appeal, though? You know, drawing people in, you saying, yes, this is a place where people can come and heal, bring all of your imperfections. But, you know, that's a tough sell, you know? How do you bring people into that and say, this is a place where you can find comfort?
One of the things that we did this past Sunday, and I think it's creating conversation and dialogue, interest and desire. This past Sunday, on the heels of the Colin Kaepernick deal with Nike, we themed our service Nike Sunday, Just Do It Sunday. And we said to our congregation, particularly our high schoolers, I challenged them, listen, on the heels of this whole Nike deal, the truth is not everybody's going to play ball and shoot baskets and those kind of things, but everybody can tap into. I asked our high schoolers, write me a one-page paper that says, here's my crazy dream in life. Here's what I want to accomplish and do. Turn that paper into us. This Sunday was the due date. In response to that, we said to them, just to create conversation and dialogue and let them know the church is concerned about them, we're giving away one to the top three writers of those papers. We're giving away $1,000 of Nike stock to each winner. That helps us to open up conversation and dialogue with millennials to let them know that it's not always about us trying to get something from you. We're trying to get something to you, and then create conversation that opens us up to now spiritual, what we call spiritual conversation and dialogue.
That's Wilbur Purvis. He's with me, along with Kim Jackson and Anne Henley Saunders. They are all church leaders, and we're talking about how pastors are engaging and energizing and encouraging dynamism in their church. Now, Wilbur, I just need to pick up on that because you got a lot of flack for that, right? You had a lot of attention and a lot of flack. I mean, conservative groups were burning Nike clothing last weekend. So that's really putting down a stake. And we heard earlier in the program, Jonathan Merritt saying, you know, people are afraid of, they don't want to hear politics in the pulpit. So is it different? Well, how is it different for your church? And why did you make that decision?
I don't necessarily call that politics, though. I think the gospel of Jesus Christ is a social gospel. It's concerned about, when I say social, I mean it's concerned about the whole man, spiritually, financially, socially. It's concerned about the whole man. And I think that's what God calls us to, what Jesus calls us to do. And so we weren't making, this is not a Democrat or a Republican thing. This is, how do we make our community better? And we started with high schoolers.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. There are so many moral issues in today's political environment, you know, questions about rights of immigrants, LGBTQ issues, economic equality. So what's the role for a preacher inside of those social issues burning with it within the congregations? How about for you, Kim?
I think that people want to come to church and know that the things that they're wrestling with during the week are relevant and that our faith has something to say to those issues. And so it has to be done carefully and certainly prayerfully. But I think it's important for us to stand up in the pulpit and to talk about what's happening around us. If this is the conversation that everyone is having around the water cooler at work, why would we not say something about it from the pulpit?
Absolutely.
And make sure that we're clear about what Scripture has to say about this, what our church tradition has taught us over the years? Because while these issues are new, in so many ways they're not new, and certainly our faith can give us some perspective and some light into it. And I think our people come to church wanting that. They want to know, how do I have these conversations with my children or with my colleagues as a person of faith?
Well, you, Kim, you grew up in the Bible Belt. Right. Were you an Episcopalian then?
I was not. I was raised Baptist.
Well, I actually, when I was trying to educate myself about religion in the Bible Belt, I asked one of our elders here who said, what are the three things I really need to understand here about religious life in the South? And he said, Baptist, Baptist, Baptist. But, you know, now you're married to a woman, and your church supports same-sex couples, welcomes LGBT people from the community. Any pushback, though, from church members, or especially hierarchy?
Right. So the Episcopal Church has done a lot of work to come to a place, not only in terms of where we are intellectually, but theologically around the issues of LGBTQ welcoming. And so our church as a whole, from our presiding bishop, Michael Curry, all the way down to our local bishop, definitely supports. And I was ordained as an out queer woman in this church. But certainly we do get visitors who come in, and every once in a while I will preach and I'll mention my wife in a sermon. And I'll have someone who's not familiar with the Episcopal Church will say, wait a minute, how is this possible? And that's just, it opens a great door for us to be able to have a conversation about, I think, the sin of Christianity that perpetuated this myth that people who were gay are not welcome into the kingdom of God. And it also opens a door for us to begin to talk about what healing and restoration looks like for so many people who have been put off by historical ways of thinking about Christianity.
How about for you, Ann Henley, at the First Presbyterian Church of Atlanta? You know, the religion is, in many ways, many people adhere to it as an idea of these are fundamentals, these are absolute, these are truths, but then you are in a social environment that is asking for adaptation. Is that a tension for you in the church?
No. I find that my faith compels me to constantly evaluate and interpret Scripture in light of my particular context, my particular faith community, and a larger global context, the larger body of Christ. Back to an earlier question, I think that the fundamental role of a pastor is to embody and reflect the truth. And also, back to an earlier point that you made about
ego. Yeah, we've rolled through a lot today.
Right? About ego. I think that ego, a constant question for me when engaging politics within the church and within the pulpit, is whether or not I am speaking on behalf of my own ego or on behalf of my faith. And living, I think that the times that we find ourselves in require us to ask those questions and require us to live between a tension of silence and pride. Mm-hmm. And I think that not being silent and not being prideful, but being truthful about what are the non-negotiables when it comes to loving God and loving our neighbor, that's that's the most compelling witness for people of faith.
Ego really did come up a lot in my conversation with Jake Hall. You know, you are in this powerful place. You're standing in front of a congregation. People are listening to you. And now, of course, people can be filming you. I'm wondering about the social media phenomenon, the idea that you're not just speaking to people inside of your church, but potentially the whole world. Does that make you think differently about what you're presenting? Wilson.
I think it makes you, you know, in terms of preparation and being ready for what you're getting ready to say, speak on Sundays, you certainly have to cover all your bases and make sure that you are well studied because, you know, while you're right, while we're speaking, people can literally
Tweeting.
Fact check. Well, tweet, not only tweet, but fact check. Is that really true what you're saying? And so it just calls you to really be prepared and do your due diligence.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have a thought about that? You're speaking to the whole world now.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about vulnerability. I think that it's important for pastors to have a certain amount of transparency with their congregation, particularly as we try to address this issue of hypocrisy. And so when I talk about my own brokenness, which I know we have some conversation about that word, but when I talk about my own brokenness, I'm aware that, wait, you know, 1,000 people might be hearing this, and am I prepared to confess to all these unknown people where my own sin is? And so I am really intentional and careful and have to be really humble about making that choice.
I think that's good, though. I think millennials want authenticity.
Absolutely.
I think they want transparency. I think in days past, we presented this image like I'm perfect, or the leader is perfect, or the leader has it all together. But I think when we can admit those when we can be transparent and admit our flaws, it creates a bond with those in our congregation, especially millennials.
This is something that James wrote on Facebook in response to the conversation earlier. I haven't left the church. I'm a conservative evangelical. My parents were first-generation evangelicals. I think if you approach church with a consumerist mentality, so what does church do for me? You're going to be disappointed. But for those seeking God, church is essential. Is that it? Have we, like so much of our society, created a kind of, this is what's in it for you. This is a consumerist mentality. We got to wrap quickly, but thoughts on that? Ann Henley, you got a thought?
Yes, yes. I mean, I do think that there is an element of consumer marketing when you are speaking to a particular audience, a particular group of people. But in recognizing that within the particular community I find myself serving, it is a diverse family. It mm-hmm. is a diverse family of not just millennials, but of many, it's intergenerational, and there is a lot of diversity of thought and theology even within one particular church. And in recognizing our own hypocrisy and recognizing a call to authenticity and truth-telling, I think that it's also important to recognize that in the wake of all that's going on in the world, it's important to take the pulse of the context, to take the pulse of the congregation, and recognizing that some weeks the congregation needs a caring message, mm-hmm. a pastoral care sermon, and other times they and I need a call to action. And in recognizing that every single week need not be the same.
Well, I'm sorry to cut a preacher off, but we are up against a break. Ann Henley Saunders, Kim Jackson, Wilbur Purvis, thank you so much for coming in to join
us. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's all we've got for On Second Thought today. We will be back again tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.